Okay, welcome to Sunstone session number 336. The generic topic of this session is growth and dispersion of Latter-day Saints in Zion and Babylon, the consequences of Mormon demographic transition. We are privileged to have two outstanding scholars of Mormonism and new religious movements in general to present papers for us this morning, Rick Phillips and Ron Lawson. Rick Phillips is currently operating out of the University of Northern Florida, and he's got a couple of books in the works. One that's already out is called Conservative Christian Identity and Same-Sex Orientation, The Case of Gay Mormons, which focuses on Latter-day Saints. And is that book available in a little...
I don't know. Maybe.
You might want to check and see if it is. Remember the name Rick Phillips. Rick has done a lot of other publishing in scholarly journals. And he has a new book on TAP, which doesn't seem to have a title yet, but which works on or focuses on how religious pluralism affects Mormon identities. So that should be good too. Ron Lawson is a professor emeritus from Queen's University.
Queen's College.
And his own background is in Seventh-day Adventism, but has been interested in somewhat parallel developments within Mormonism in the 20th century, and has tracked Mormonism as well as Seventh-day Adventism, and has a lot of interesting theoretical kinds of insights that he's developed over the years. Ron, I have a paucity of information on this little bio sheet that I'm reading from about Ron's work. I know it to be extensive. I just don't have titles to give to you. So if any of you find Ron's paper of interest, I'm sure after the session today he can fill you in on more details. So we'll get started, and I'm going to turn the time over to Rick first. Rick has generously told Ron that he would be shorter. He's not going to use up all of his designated time in order to allow Ron more time to develop a much, I'm not going to say meatier paper, but one that covers... I won't even say that, but it just covers more ground than Rick's does. So, Rick, go ahead.
Thank you. I'm going to sort of half read and half talk. This is from a greatly abridged version of the paper I'm working on Utah's demography. Utah is known as the Mormon homeland and is characterized as a place where the LDS Church dominates politics, economics, and culture. Few would dispute that the church is among the state's most powerful institutions. However, on July 24, 2005, the Salt Lake Tribune ran a front-page story declaring that after rising throughout most of the 20th century, the proportion of Utah citizens belonging to the church began declining in 1989. In a series of follow-ups, the Tribune confirmed that the trend persists, claiming that, quote, "This demographic shift will undoubtedly have major impacts on the psyche of Utah Mormons, the makeup of neighborhoods, and possibly even missionary efforts internationally," end quote. The church responded to the Tribune with a shrug, issuing the following statement, quote, "The church has always extended a hand of friendship and fellowship to those of other faiths and will continue to do so," end quote. If Mormon leaders are unperturbed by shifts in Utah's religious demography, it is probably because Utahns comprise a decreasing share of the world's Latter-day Saints. In 1930, almost half of all Mormons lived in Utah. Today, the figure stands at around 13% and dropping. The church hierarchy is accustomed to managing an organization whose members are a religious minority in places where the church has little influence on secular affairs. Utah Mormons may soon be like the rest of their co-religionists, so why should it matter? I contend that it may matter a great deal. I argue that the religious vitality of Latter-day Saints is bolstered by large, dense Mormon communities, and that a diminishing presence in Utah and the Intermountain West could retard overall rates of LDS church activity, tithing receipts, and the size of the missionary corps, just as the Tribune predicts. I'm going to begin by recounting the historical relationship between Mormons and their homeland, and then show how this relationship affects the religiousness of Latter-day Saints in Utah and surrounding environments. And I'll conclude by considering how Utah's changing demographics might impact Mormon religiousness and why this could be consequential. The Mormon pioneers who crossed the plains for their religion were more than members of an extraordinary sect. The followers of Brigham Young traversed the continent seeking to establish Zion, the kingdom of God on earth, in the valley of the Great Salt Lake. The Mormon Zion was to be a place where congregation and neighborhood were consolidated, where church and state were fused, and where religious and community leaders were synonymous. A fundamental component of this theocratic vision was the doctrine of gathering, that people should live in enclaves. Gathering instilled in early Mormons the belief that a shared locale and unity of faith are reciprocal. Throughout the 19th century, Mormon missionaries fanned out to proclaim this nascent Zion, and converts to the faith were urged to leave their old lives behind and emigrate to the Utah Territory. And we see the consequences of that. By the dawn of the 20th century, the fledgling state of Utah and Mormon environs in adjacent states were increasingly peopled by a new generation born in the region and steeped from infancy in the ethos of the faith. For these Latter-day Saints, notions of religion, kin, and homeland were intertwined, and their lifelong habitation in Zion's hearth made Mormonism axiomatic. Social geographers hold that the web of settlements founded by Brigham Young became a Mormon culture region, where religious and public norms were conflated, and church leaders enjoyed at least as much prestige as their secular counterparts, if such distinctions were made at all. The gathering assembled the Mormons in one region, but they soon learned that the desert was a stingy host. Much of the land was too dry to farm, and there were few areas with enough water to sustain a settlement. Out of necessity, church leaders suspended the gathering. Instead of coming to Zion, eager converts were urged to stay and abide by the principles of Zion wherever they were. The repeal of the gathering marked the end of an era for the LDS Church and altered the Mormon conception of Zion. Once a literal homeland in the desert, Zion was transformed in the hearts and minds of the Latter-day Saints from a place to an ideal, a symbolic community united by a common faith. The Mormons were no longer required to gather physically, but rather to gather morally. They were not to be geographically sequestered, but rather set apart from the cultural mainstream by their lifestyle. The shifting emphasis from Zion as place to Zion as ideal is a watershed in the transformation of Mormonism, but the demographic changes accompanying this shift posed a threat to the Mormon sense of identity. Mitigating religious and cultural pluralism had always helped the church maintain its distinctiveness, but now growing numbers of Mormons were religious minorities in pluralistic settings. To address this situation, church leaders sought to compensate for the loss of the concentrated population base promoted by the gathering. They did this by consolidating and centralizing their authority and standardizing the church's policies and programs. Leaders insisted that there be no regional differences in church practice and theology in order to minimize the possibility of local variants of Mormon culture. Imposing a uniform organizational structure on all members replaced gathering as a mechanism for inculcating a consistent religious identity. As membership dispersed throughout the 20th century, the centralization and standardization of Mormonism intensified, culminating in the correlation movement of the 1960s. As a result, LDS wards in the United States are much more uniform in their operation than Catholic parishes or congregations in the major Protestant denominations. For most contemporary Latter-day Saints, the organizational culture wrought by correlation is the wellspring of their Mormon identity. These days, the typical church member is a first-generation convert with few family ties in the faith, living in a place where Mormonism is a minority religion. This is a far cry from the dense mosaic of wards along the Wasatch Front that typifies the gathering. Now, here's the setup, because we have standardized norms for how you should behave, and the church organization is the same. Given that these worthiness standards and lifestyle mandates are standardized across political and cultural boundaries, it stands to reason that comparing rates of church activity among Mormons who live in the Mormon culture region with those in other locales will uncover how being gathered affects the religiousness of contemporary Latter-day Saints. If correlation, communications technologies, and temples dotting the globe have made gathering irrelevant, then activity rates shouldn't vary much. Now, it's hard to test this hypothesis. The data are hard to come by. The church does not typically release its proprietary data to researchers. But luckily, the church is now large enough in the United States that subsamples of Mormons can be gleaned from major social science surveys that poll respondents about religious participation. And I use the most comprehensive of these, which is a survey called the General Social Survey, which is funded by the National Science Foundation and has been tracking trends in public opinion and religious behavior since 1972. Outside of the U.S. Census, the GSS is the most used data set in all of the social sciences, and sociologists of Mormonism regard it as a reliable source of data on American Mormons. Now, the General Social Survey doesn't identify respondents by state, but rather locates them within nine regions. The Mountain region is comprised of Arizona, Colorado, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming. So it's not a perfect analogy to the Mormon culture region, but this mountain region subsumes the Mormon culture region. While the mountain states contain only about 6% of the total U.S. population, they hold over half of the nation's Latter-day Saints. And in the paper, I talk a lot about, you know, how I operationalize the data. I won't go into that here. It's rather excruciating. So although it's not perfect, the GSS mountain region serves as a suitable proxy for the Mormon culture region. With respect to church attendance, GSS data reveal that Mormons in the Mormon culture region attend church more often than other United States Mormons. A measure of church attendance and a comparison of regional rates using aggregated GSS data from 1972 to 2008 appears on this slide. The table shows that nearly two-thirds of self-identified Mormons in the culture region report weekly church attendance. Conversely, outside the culture region, Mormons are more than twice as likely to say that they never attend church. Another way to look at this is to look at differences in the average size of stakes from around the world. Given that stakes tend to split when there are more active members than there are callings for them to take, it holds that regions with fewer members per stake probably have higher activity rates than regions with more members per stake. And as you can see, Utah and Idaho average, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,500 members per stake, while the worldwide mean is you know, over 1,000 more members per stake. Finally, the evidence shows that Mormon men in Utah have traditionally been more likely to hold the Melchizedek priesthood than their counterparts elsewhere. For several years in the early 80s, the church published enumerations of Melchizedek priesthood holders. Figures from 1982, which is the last year these data were issued, show that 70% of men in Utah that were eligible for Melchizedek priesthood ordination had been ordained. And you can see that in the other 49 states, it was barely half, and outside the United States, it was less than a third. So in sum, virtually all available sources show that Mormons in the culture region, and particularly Utah, have exhibited higher levels of religious participation than those living almost anywhere else. It seems that leaders' predilection for gathering was based on sound sociological principles. This conclusion also runs counter to a common Mormon stereotype that Latter-day Saints in the mission field are more committed than Utah Mormons, who are sometimes suspected of taking the church for granted. It appears that this stereotype is false. But since the church is largely standardized across political and cultural boundaries, what precisely is it about the Mormon culture region that has sustained such robust activity? And I argue that it's two things. First are extensive kin ties in the faith. And the GSS records people's religious affiliation when they're given the survey. It asks, what religion are you? And then it asks, what religion were you when you were 16 years old? For the purposes of this paper, I'll assume that Mormons who report that they were also LDS at age 16 are lifelong members. And obviously those who say they were something else when they were 16 and say they're Mormon now would be converts. Based on this definition, in the Mormon culture region, 60% of Latter-day Saints are lifetime members, while 40% are converts. And this proportion is likely higher in Utah. Outside the culture region, these ratios are essentially reversed. 35.5% are lifetime members, while about two-thirds are converts. Hence, Mormons in the culture region are more likely to have been raised in the church and to have significant family ties in the faith. These family ties promote church activity. This property of kin networks is clearly evident with respect to temple weddings. In Utah, temple weddings are often attended by the extended family, while most members of the ward see the couple at the reception. This situation, which is taken for granted in Utah, provides subtle additional motivation to keep ties current, since only full tie payers are worthy to enter the temple. So one might be inclined to pay tithes for religious reasons, and one might be inclined to pay tithes because one does not want to miss the wedding of one's favorite niece. So there are incentives beyond sort of the institutional scope of the church. And these circumstances are reversed for first-generation converts in the mission field. The temple service is attended primarily by friends in the ward, and family greet the couple after the wedding. Having kin in the church improves the ability to retain children in the faith. When parents in Utah are inactive, grandparents sometimes take children to church or even ensure that ordinances like baptism or Aaronic priesthood ordination are performed. The children of inactive converts in the mission field have a slimmer chance of being nurtured in the church and are likely to become or remain inactive themselves. In addition to family ties, social density itself promotes religious activity. Sometimes almost by chance. For instance, where Mormons predominate, romances that blossom at work or school are likely to be with other Latter-day Saints, and circumstance alone ensures that Utah Mormons will probably marry in the faith, even if it isn't an explicit religious priority. And sociologists have long known that homogamous marriages, marriages between two people of the same faith, promote religious activity much more than marriages between people of opposite faiths, all things being equal. If religious commitments sort of wax and wane over the life course, having a spouse of the same faith sort of drag you to church when you're not feeling like going sort of keeps religious activity high. And the data are quite clear that rates of intermarriage are very low in Utah, around 13%, whereas outside the Mormon culture region, it's triple that, something like triple that. Social density also promotes religious activity by fusing church and community norms. In many Utah towns, co-workers, classmates, and neighbors are likely to be Latter-day Saints. Conducting business or participating in civic activities usually involves interacting with co-religionists. Because of this, a Mormon in Utah who is tempted to put beer or coffee in a shopping cart must worry not only about being seen by another ward member, but also by virtually anyone he or she knows, because violating church strictures can draw sanctions from the larger community. And I always remember my dad, who worked 6 days a week and Sunday was his only day off. And he was very proud of his yard, but he never had time to work in it. And he used to always say to me, "I don't know which is the bigger sin, doing yard work on Sunday, or the fact that I refrain from yard work on Sunday because I don't want the neighbors to see." And when I moved to graduate school to New Jersey, I thought to myself, Dad could be LDS here and keep an immaculate yard. Wouldn't be a problem. The tendency for Latter-day Saints to be more active where they predominate even holds within Utah itself. In an earlier study based on official church data, I showed that as the Mormon proportion of the population in Utah counties increases, the percentage of adult LDS men ordained to the Melchizedek priesthood rises in concert. Thus, available evidence suggests that even within Utah, the greater the concentration of Mormons, the higher the level of church activity. And San Juan County is the exception that proves the rule, because if you remove the population of Native Americans on the reservation, it goes right over here where it belongs. Now, obviously, having extended family in the church and living in a concentrated LDS community are not the sole predictors of Mormon religious activity. Most Mormons have a strong commitment to their faith. Stalwart members are likely to stay active regardless of where they live. However, the influence of LDS kin and a vibrant religious subculture helps sustain activity among those whose subjective religious commitments might wax and wane over time and serve as a safety net to undergird the activity of those who might otherwise fall away. But the erosion of the Mormon majority discussed earlier in this paper seems to be fraying the safety net. Recall that the Mormon share of Utah's population began dropping in 1989 and has fallen consistently since. since declines are also evident in the states comprising the Mormon, these declines are also evident in the states comprising the Mormon culture region. If Mormon church activity is bolstered by dense concentrations of Latter-day Saints, then activity rates in this region should be falling as well. Preliminary evidence from recent waves of GSS data suggests that this is so. Now, because Mormons are a small percentage of the U.S. population, they are a small percentage of each wave of the nationally representative GSS sample. Hence, it's too soon to draw definitive conclusions about recent trends in Mormon church attendance. However, comparing data from the last decade of the GSS with earlier years of the study indicates that church attendance in the Mormon culture region has declined. The number of Latter-day Saints who say they attend church never or less than once a month has increased from 23.4% here to 45.7%. Those who claim to attend church once a month or more have dropped from 76.6% to 54.4%. Now, while some cells in this table have only a few cases, the analysis meets the assumption of the chi-square statistic, and the odds that this pattern appears in the data by chance are less than 1 in 20. And there's the voodoo for those of you who are educated in voodoo. By contrast, there is no corresponding change in church attendance outside the Mormon culture region over the same time frame, stayed the same. And there is now no significant difference between church attendance rates inside versus outside the Mormon culture region. But the most significant trend among Mormons in Utah and the Intermountain West is not increasing in activity, but rising rates of disaffiliation. Research shows that the LDS Church has a high rate of conversion, but also a high rate of defection. Recall that we define converts as those who were not Latter-day Saints at age 16, but who were LDS when they completed the GSS survey. Disaffiliates are the opposite. They were LDS at 16, but claimed another faith, or no faith at all, on the GSS survey. From 1972 to 1998, 94.2% of GSS respondents living in the Mormon culture region who were LDS at age 16 were still members of the church. That's, I was LDS at 16, I'm LDS now. While just 5.8% have defected. I was LDS when I'm 16, I'm not LDS now. For these same years, 75.8% of those living outside the Mormon culture region who were LDS at 16 were still church members, and 24.2% had left. Thus, from 1972 to 1998, the percentage of disaffiliates living outside the Mormon culture region was four times greater than within it. This disparity is statistically significant, and the odds that it is due to chance are less than 1 in 1,000. But things are changing. Since 1998, the percentage of disaffiliates within the Mormon culture region has more than quintupled, from 5.8% to 32.2%. This accords nicely with new data from a research from with a new survey from the Pew Research Center showing that about almost a third of Latter-day Saints who were raised in the faith no longer consider themselves LDS. The interesting thing about this is we're looking at self-identified Latter-day Saints. When I ask you, what is your faith? And you say, I'm a Mormon. You're tabulated by a Mormon, as a Mormon. A lot of these people are still on church rolls. They haven't been purged from church rolls, so they're still counted among the, you know, almost 14 million. But if you ask them what they are, they say that they're either nothing or some other faith. Okay? And now what you see is that there's no statistical, this is not statistically significant. You see no statistically significant difference between the number of disaffiliates in the Mormon culture region and outside of it. In the past 10 years, levels of apostasy in the Mormon culture region have risen to levels traditionally seen in other parts of the nation. The other way to look at it is to look at the ratio of converts per disaffiliate by year. Okay, so here's 1972 to 1998. Inside the Mormon culture region, there were 3.5 people who joined the church via conversion for every one person that left. Outside the Mormon culture region, there were 1.62 people who joined the church via conversion for every one person that left. Now look at the change. Outside the Mormon culture region, it's a one-for-one exchange. For every person coming in through conversion, one person leaves. In the Mormon culture region, the ratio is now 0.5. That means that for every person who enters the church in the Mormon culture region through the process of conversion. Lifetime members are still having babies. But for every person who enters the church through conversion, two lifetime members exit the faith. For every one convert in, two lifetime members leave. This is self-reported membership, but they still count on church rolls. The percentage of Latter-day Saints living in the Mormon culture region, and particularly Utah, is steadily shrinking. Mormons in the region have historically been overrepresented among weekly church attenders, Melchizedek priesthood holders, and by implication, full-time missionaries and tithe payers. Mormons in the region are an important base for the church, providing a disproportionate share of the money and labor that goes towards funding and staffing the church's programs and outreach. The erosion of this demographic foundation coincides with a drop in activity in rates of church activity. Preliminary evidence suggests that activity in this traditional stronghold has declined to levels more characteristic of regions lacking the extensive family ties and regional subculture that buttress church activity in the Intermountain West, and that's because this demographic change is eroding the safety net. These findings are tentative, and there is insufficient evidence to draw firm conclusions, but despite their sensationalism, the Salt Lake Tribune's predictions for Utah's future may merit some scrutiny.
It's good to be here with you. I set out to do a study of global Adventism. I enjoyed the study so much that I went to 59 countries and I've interviewed 3,500 people. Along the way, I have for about 15 years taught a course on groups that were born in America and which have become global. So in other words, in particular, Mormons, Adventists, Witnesses, and Pentecostals. And out of that came this study, which is in fact in second stage review in two different journals because it's too long to be one paper. It was important for me to leave the Adventist ghetto and to compare and to see how things varied for similar groups. I begin by comparing the global growth and distributions and the SES, actually, socioeconomic status, of the three groups, Mormons, Adventists, and Witnesses. And that is using the official church data. And then I go on, I have data from 20 censuses in all continents, and I test the reliability of the membership data for all three groups. I should say something about the way in which the way the groups count their membership varies. Mormons count not just those who've been baptized, but as you know, they count children as well. Adventists count only those who've been baptized, and they tend to be baptized a little bit later than Mormons. Witnesses count, and this is an important difference, only those who witness regularly. Okay? So that's a different way of counting. This becomes important later on. Next. So here's the growth over time. You'll notice that Mormons, of course, were founded first, and they therefore had a lead. But Adventists almost always, once they started, grew at a faster rate than Mormons did, and the official numbers passed Mormons in the late 1990s. There was a huge witness growth after World War II, especially in Europe, where they had a sort of a halo effect because they were persecuted by the Nazis and they were admired for this. And so they attracted a lot of new members in the first two decades, or first 15 years after World War II. Growth declined after 1990, especially for Mormons and for Witnesses. Next. Here you have comparing the groups in pairs, and you can see that the Adventist versus Mormon percentage changes regularly over time, from 6% in 1870 to 118% 2008. Similarly, the Adventists, the Witnesses have become smaller compared to Adventists over time, while Witnesses and Mormons stay about the same. Next. And here you have the total growth of the three groups from 1950 to 2008. And you'll notice that all have strong growth rates, and that the sizes of all three groups have been transformed in that period. Next. Now, I look at the average annual increases per quinquennium starting in 2008 and going back every 5 years. And you'll notice, first of all, that the growth rates of all three groups declined after 1990, Adventists less so, and we need to know that that some of the decline in Adventists is because since 2003 they've been doing a really serious attempt to clean their rolls. And so that is included in the decline since 2003. Next. This compares the annual total number of baptisms, and there's some very striking figures here. You'll notice that the Mormons, which is just convert baptisms, that's what I was able to find, but that's most of the baptisms, declined over time from 1989 through to 2004, and then became rather unstable recovery after that. Witnesses similarly followed the same sort of pattern. On the other hand, Adventist baptisms per year increased greatly, especially up to 1999, and then remained strong after 1999, though, of course, because their membership is increasing, the percentage increase is declining. Next. And this does the thing graphically, and you can see how dramatic it is, the total number of baptisms per quinquennium for Adventists has really risen, whereas the other two have declined a little. Next. Now, here we start to look at the distribution in different parts of the world of the three groups. And I'm comparing 1960 with 2006. Note, first of all, that Mormons should have led because they're the oldest, and they early on became interested in taking their message to the world. But no, because they moved the people who they converted to Utah and therefore didn't create a home base in the countries where they went, this didn't happen to nearly the same extent. And then later, when they did become more focused on keeping people where they were, they focused on particular parts, especially Latin America, Polynesia, and they, for theological reasons, neglected those of African descent in Africa and in the Caribbean. And then finally, they stayed out of the communist countries. I think because of a strong identity with US foreign policy and with capitalism, so that they went to Japan with the American soldiers after World War II. They went to Russia after the fall of communism, and they're still not present in China. In 1960, therefore, the Mormons are especially concentrated in the United States. Notice that the witnesses are in the United States and also in Europe and growing rapidly in Africa. Other means basically Eastern Europe. They were trying to avoid persecution there under the communists. In 2006, all have globalized. All are dropping percentage, therefore, in North America. The Mormons growing particularly in Latin America, the Philippines, Japan. The witnesses declining in Western Europe, but growing in Russia, Eastern Europe, and also in Africa and parts of Asia. Adventists are growing especially in the developing worlds, in Africa, India, East Asia, China, South Korea, the Philippines, Latin America. And aside, they have a particular advantage in Africa. Of course, Adventists were established before communism, before the wars, because they were early, and they had to deal with governments. And they joined the communist-sponsored Protestant organization in China. But because they insisted on worshipping on Saturday, they really became a separate denomination, because they worship on Saturday in the same churches as the Protestants worship on Sunday. So they were able to retain their independent identity in China. Next. This looks at 2006, and you can see here very clearly where the groups are concentrated. The Mormons in North America, with some strong growth in Latin America. They've taken the lead in Australia and New Zealand. The witnesses in much less strong in North America. Strong still, though the growth declining, in Western and Eastern Europe in the former USSR. And the Adventists standing out almost everywhere in the developing world. Next. Here we see the changing proportion of the total membership of Mormons, Adventists, and Witnesses in the developed world. So this is 2006 all the way through to 1960 to 2006. And you'll notice that they're all falling in the developed world, but that the Mormons are still much more concentrated there than the Witnesses, and the Witnesses much more concentrated there than the Adventists. So these three groups are very differently spread globally, very differently. There's some very unexpected results which we're about to start to see. Next. Now this is the membership in the developed world in 2006. Again, you'll see that the Mormons are strong in North America, that the only place in Europe where they're the strongest is in the United Kingdom, and they lead in Australia and New Zealand. The Witnesses lead in every country in Europe except for the UK and Iceland. They're well ahead in Japan. Adventists are the only places where they're ahead in the developed world are South Korea, which is one of the most recent additions to the developed world, and in Iceland, little Iceland. Next. Now let's look at the changes over time in categories according to the gross national income per capita. Okay, so these are divided according to UN statistics into high, medium, and low income. And you'll notice that the Mormons started out very much in the high, and they're now in the high and medium. The witnesses had a little bit more medium in the beginning, and they're now more medium than they are high, but like the Mormons, very low in the low income areas. Adventists were high in the medium. This became higher, and then the low grew up until the largest by far. Well, the largest in 2006 is in the low income countries. So Adventists have had the greatest success in the poorest category. Mormons and Witnesses have been growing in the second group, but the whole picture has been transformed over time. Next. Now, this is comparing the distribution of the three groups' members according to countries, again categorized according to gross national income per capita. This is 2006. And what I want you to notice in particular, that Mormons and Adventists are mirror images of each other. Okay, the Mormons are very poorly represented in the very poor countries. The Adventists are very well represented there, and not well represented in the highest income categories. And Witnesses are in between, though closer to the Mormons than they are to the Adventists. Now, this is still using official data. When we get to the census data, the differences will be even greater. That's next. This gives you the percentage of where they're concentrated over time, and you can see the same sort of pattern coming out. They concentrate in very different GNI categories. Now let's come to the next one, and here we use census data for the first time, and I focus on Mexico. Now this is a chart which shows divides the people up according to into three categories: earning less than the minimum wage, earning between one and three times the minimum wage, and earning three times the minimum wage or more. And you can see that the Mormons are highest in the middle category, but very high in the highest category, the highest of all. Whereas the Adventists run the opposite direction. They're almost 50% in the less than minimum wage category. The concentration is in different parts of the country. The Adventists are concentrated in the south. The Mormons and the Witnesses are concentrated in Mexico City and in the north. Next. And this looks at the percentage in the income categories, and you can see the same sort of effect. Now, this is surprising. Adventists run three universities in Mexico. What's going on is that their people are too poor to afford to go to their own universities. And there's a lot of other people attending their universities. Now, they do proselytize fairly successfully among those students, but their own people are too poor. Next. Now, this looks at the highest education of those identifying in the Mexican census. And I've put it in bold so it can become its most clear to you. But you can see that Adventists have 60% in the two bottom categories, no education and primary school. Whereas Mormons have 50% in the top two categories. So that Mormons are much better educated than Adventists, in spite of the huge Adventist education system there. And the Witnesses who don't advocate education at all lie between the Mormons and the Adventists. Next. Now, this one collapses the category so it's clearer. And you can see that the Adventists are mostly in the low education, the Mormons are in the high education, the witnesses are in between. Next. We now turn to the Canadian census, and we compare in the right-hand columns, you've got the Canadian population. Then we're comparing that with Mormons, Witnesses, and Adventists. And Adventists are much more likely to be immigrants than are Witnesses. Witnesses are about the same as the Canadian population, and Mormons less likely to be immigrants. And when you look at the recent immigrants, that's the green that we've got there, they migrated, this is the 2000 year census. So those migrating in the 10 years before that, now the witnesses also fall below the Canadian norm, whereas the Adventists are considerably higher than the Canadian norm. Next. And this gives you the proportion. And it shows numbers as well. So let me say that Adventists have risen to prominence in some countries. For example, in Papua New Guinea, when I was there, the Governor General, the Deputy Prime Minister, several members of Cabinet, four members of the Supreme Court, all were Adventists, and they have a huge membership in Papua New Guinea. And that's because when there were only five high schools, they ran one of them. And the best known of them. But they're more rural than the Witnesses or the Mormons. Similarly, in this last year, the head of the Adventist Church in Jamaica has been chosen as the Governor General. When I was there, there were four Adventists in Cabinet. So yes, they have achieved prominent positions in some developing world countries. But nevertheless, most Jamaican Adventists are using church conduits to go. Initially they went to Britain and then they went to Canada, and now they're coming to the United States. So because it's a poor country, they still want to leave. Next. Now, how reliable are the church statistics? Now I'm going to start looking at this. Let's begin with Mexico. In a census, the people say, this is what I am. And that's presumably a better measure than church statistics, which may be terribly out of date. If what people are saying they are and the church statistics are the same, it should be one. Okay? Now you'll notice that Mormons are way down in Mexico. That the number of people claiming to be Mormons is only about a quarter of those who are on the church rolls. Adventists are very close to one, whereas Witnesses are nearly up to two, which means there's a whole lot of people who do not witness and therefore are not counted on the official witness statistics, but who in the census say, I am a witness. The Mormon missionaries in particular try to convert poor people, but the poor people don't stick. I have a friend who's an anthropologist who's worked very closely in Latin America with Mormons in three or four countries, and he says that about half of the people who were baptized leave within 3 months. Next. Other people have looked at a variety of censuses, and I've here brought them all together. 6 countries. And you can see that there's a pattern here. It's more exaggerated when you get to the developing world. In Canada and Australia, the Mormon ratio is, well, in Canada, above 0.5. In Australia, just below 0.5. Similarly, the witnesses have got more people claiming to be witnesses out of proportion to what they would list as people doing the witnessing in the developing countries. And Adventists tend to be about one, about what is expected throughout. Next one. Now, I found 20 countries. To be in the census, you first of all got to ask the question. The United States, of course, doesn't ask what religion you are. So there's no US state data. And there's also got to be enough people who are Christians for them to put Christians separately. And these groups have got to be strong enough for them to be there separately. And I looked at censuses all over the world, and I found these 20. Now, you'll notice that 4 of them are without Mormons. In order to get a balanced sample, in Africa and in the Caribbean, because Mormons came so late there, they're not represented in the censuses. So I chose 4 countries where witnesses and Adventists were both there. And I chose one country in the South Pacific, Tonga, where the witnesses are not listed. But you can see that it's the pattern is very clear, that the Mormons, with the exception of Papua New Guinea, which is an outlier, as we would say, the Mormons are always less than 0. So in other words, fewer people claiming to be Mormons than there are on the church rolls. The Adventists are about 1, though higher in the developed countries, in the undeveloped countries, where the number of children, and therefore unbaptized, but counted in the census, is higher. And the witnesses are considerably greater than they claim almost everywhere, and especially in some of the countries of the developing world. Notice that the 6 countries of the developed world are at the top 6. Now, let's come to slide 24. Here we have a graph of the whole situation. You see Papua New Guinea as the outlier. But the pattern is very clear visually there. Mormons lower than the official membership, witnesses much higher than their number of people witnessing. This means a huge exit rate for Mormons. It is unclear to what extent the inactive witnesses in fact attend church. You can say I am a witness, but hardly ever go. And of course, it doesn't prove that the people who say that they're Mormons or Adventists are going to church. But this is at least this is who they identified with. Next. So here's the mean. I pointed out that there was considerable consistency, and the Mormons literally come in at 0.5. The Adventists come in as a little bit higher than 1, and the witnesses is a little bit higher than 2. Now, I was able to therefore run a ratio comparing the official membership with the census claimed this is who I am. And this comparison is shown in the last slide. The rolls in 2008 gave 13.5 million Mormons. But I would estimate that from the census results, that their real membership is about just over 7 million. Adventists, the official membership was just under 16 million in 2008. But the census estimate is 18.3. And witnesses claim 7.1 million preachers, people who are actually witnessing regularly. But the number of census adherents rises steeply to 15.3 million. So that's where we are.
Okay, we actually have a fair amount of time available for questions and answers. So if you have questions or just some comments you wanted to share, please step forward, speak into the microphone, and your questions and comments will be entertained by our two speakers.
I'm curious, when you were showing the financial comparison of the richer or poorer people, would this be somewhat offset by the different methodology of mission work, where I think Adventists, I'm assuming, follow more of a Protestant concept of going to the poor and the needy, and they have so many humanitarian efforts that I would think they would have more poor people from simply that concept. And at least anecdotally, I hear Mormon missionaries telling me of being told specifically to proselyte in more affluent neighborhoods. So would that be some of why we're seeing that disparity?
I'm glad you asked that question, because it was in my notes and I somehow managed to leave it out. One of the key explanations of the patterns that I found was that each group proselytizes in a different way, and who they aim at is shaped by the way in which they proselytize. Mormon missionaries are mostly foreigners there for a 2-year period. It's costly, and these are fairly well-educated people doing mission work, but I'm told by those who do the missions that they very often go to the poor because they are the easiest to convert. So a lot of poor people are baptized, but these do not stay. The church is not conducive to them. They do not feel comfortable there, and they leave fast. The witnesses count on their members to do the witnessing. That's who does it. So they found it more difficult to spread because they had a fairly limited number of people who were willing to go abroad. And this happened more gradually. And also they grow in particularly in urban areas. So they grow, they're urban, and they're using who they are. They're time rather than money centered. Adventists got a totally different way of doing things. Adventists built institutions. Wherever they went, they built schools and hospitals. And these became the way of reaching where they were. Where were they built? They were built not successfully in Europe, which is why they didn't do very well in Europe, because it was hard to get accreditation for their schools and hard to get permission to get to build hospitals, because there were so many hospitals already. And that put them in bad situations in Europe. But in the developing world, the colonial powers were only too happy to have them come in and do things which the colonial powers didn't really want to do because they were wanting to take money out rather than put money in. And in particular, they had them build schools and hospitals in the areas that were remote, in rural areas. And that's why Adventists have so much been converting the poor people. They've got these educational systems, but they convert people who can't afford to go to them. Now, as they've realised that, they've become much more diverse in their strategies, so that they now run... They don't do very much door-to-door work, the way Mormons and Witnesses do, but they run evangelistic campaigns. And everybody is encouraged to run evangelistic campaigns. And they do this in everywhere from pastors and lay people, including lots of women evangelists, to now the thing which marks many Adventist churches is not a steeple, but is a disc. And there'll be a famous Adventist evangelist who preaches and is translated immediately and is broadcast in churches all over the world, perhaps, or all over a region. So that's another way. And they've really gone into shortwave radio, into FM radio, into internet radio, and also into satellite television. They are reaching... They're putting particular emphasis now on the 10 to 40 window, in the Northern Hemisphere, in other words, India, China, Southeast Asia, Middle East, Northern Africa. And they're reaching these areas extremely successfully through radio. But again, these strategies seem to be reaching poor people by and large. They're most successful in reaching those. So the strategies used are very different, and they have the effect of converting different kinds of people.
Ron, before you get too comfortable there, let me ask a follow-up question. You seem to be addressing primarily the question of recruitment strategies and comparing them. What about retention? And then, you know, I think you've alluded to that. When Mormon missionaries convert poor people, they don't retain them. And Adventists seem to recruit poor people and retain them. So could you comment a little bit on retention strategies?
I've been to Adventist services. This is not very common, but I've been to Adventist services. For example, the one I'm thinking of was in Guatemala, where there were people in the congregation who were unshod. They were that poor. They came barefooted. I don't think that would be acceptable in a Mormon meeting. And of course there is a real sense of possibility of upward mobility in joining Adventism. For example, in Papua New Guinea, where there's been enormous growth in the highlands, which was a pretty remote area until after World War II, when Adventists arrived, and they started to convert people there. There was no money. Money was counted in terms of pigs. And you didn't keep the pigs very long, because you had an obligation to your kin to have a party. But Adventists said to their converts, no parties, because Adventists don't eat pork, and they don't drink alcohol, And there was always alcohol at these parties, and there was spirit worship at these parties. So Adventists were removed in some way, from the kinship structure. And they became much more individualistic, just as money was being introduced. And when I got to the Highlands, I said, why are Adventists doing so well? And the answer I got was, God blesses Adventists. They get rich. So, yes, that happens in some places, but in other places it doesn't. And you know, they've got these universities all over Africa, but the majority of the students in Africa are non-Adventist students because they can't afford to go there. But certainly they're much better at keeping the poor people than the Mormons seem to be.
With respect to retention, you know, demographically, and retention demographically, and this may be a difficult question to answer, but I know from personal experience that we all know that, I suppose, that there's a renewed emphasis from Salt Lake City. I mean, they pay attention to this tax of data, and there's a renewed emphasis for the last decade of figuring out how to improve our retention within these hundred members. Is there any data to suggest that maybe having an effect at all in terms of that emphasis?
Well, I think the Preach My Gospel system, the new system, was an attempt, and the idea of sort of raising the bar was an attempt at this kind of thing. Because the number of missionaries had been declining, and certainly the number of missionaries per church member had been declining. Now, the explanation for this raising the bar is that we're going to get a better class of missionaries. The cynic would say that the number of, because of declining birth rates, the pool of 19-year-olds was shrinking. As I look at the data, the number of baptisms per missionary has been declining and has declined steadily and now seems unstable. But it's too early to tell. I'm eagerly awaiting the 2010 GSS data, and we're all, you know, waiting with bated breath for a new round of census data. But still, you know, even the sort of new Preach My Gospel rules, missionaries are instructed to set a date for baptism after the second discussion. And one of the things that's interesting about Mormonism is it's hard to live, but easy to join. And, you know, if you think about how Catholicism does things, the rite of Christian initiation for adults admits new Catholics only once a year. Can you imagine, you know, how much better retention would be if the Latter-day Saints adopted a proselytizing system like the rite of Christian initiation for adults? You'd have much higher retention, but what would happen? The number of convert baptisms would plunge. You cannot have your cake and eat it too. You can either baptize tons and tons of people hastily and retain few of them, or you could baptize, you can nurture converts slowly and retain them. In earlier papers that I've published, I did one study of a ward in New Jersey where the local ecclesiastical leaders would constantly tell the missionaries, slow down, you know. And why would the missionaries not slow down? Because their mission president is giving them pressure to baptize. In some respects, you know, I think when the 19th century, in the 19th century, the saints could look around at the valley and see irrigation projects and buildings go up, and they could sort of like look at the colonization of the Great Basin and assess the progress of the kingdom. When the church transformed from a government to a more corporate structure, how do you assess the progress of the kingdom? And I think what ended up happening is these rising, you know, baptismal figures, these rising numbers, these, you know, ever-increasing charts of church growth became almost like a stock report that you hand to the members. And it's very difficult to sort of, this notion of exponential growth was almost imbued with theological significance. And so it's very, very difficult to sort of And, you know, I don't know that things like this should be provocative, but if you tell Mormons there aren't 14 million self-identified members, there are probably about half that. I've told many Mormons this. They become testy. Some of them become testy. And why should they become testy? I don't know, you know, there's no scriptural doctrinal notion that the stone that rolls forward to fill the whole earth needs to roll at any particular pace. It's just sort of a cultural artifact that, you know, we need to be seen as A, the fastest growing church, which, you know, we're not, and the, you know, even of these three American originals, the idea that we're the largest, and we're not. So I don't know, I sort of veered away from your question, but I think the problem with retention is that people are baptized and confirmed members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints before they're converted. You know, the costs of membership don't kick in until well after you join.
I suspect that this, the emphasis on retention has an element of ongoing conversion so that we try to complete that process before we lose somebody. But
yeah, I mean, the way to do it would be, okay, we're going to concentrate on, you know, if you said, you know, we're going to concentrate on conversion, that we're going to retain every person we baptize, that could only be accomplished by baptizing fewer people. There are wards, Ron and I have the same friend who studies Latin America, and there are wards that are so deluged with new converts arriving every day that there's no possible way that these people can be fellowshipped. And I noticed this in the ward in New Jersey. There were people who would be baptized and then never return to church. And what happened was the members became jaded about the people that the missionaries were working with because they saw so many of them, you know, get baptized and then promptly fall away. Whereas if there was a more collaborative relationship between the full-time missionaries and the members of the ward, conversion would take place, you know, at a more reasonable pace, and members would be integrated into the congregation as they joined the church. But really, sort of local leaders and missionaries are on a sort of have different directives. Local leaders are trying to build a community and sort of sustain a community of believers. And missionaries' imperative is to baptize as many people as they can. And those two, you know, directives are often working across purposes. And it's because the missionary program is, you know, so centralized. This is not something that plagues the Jehovah's Witnesses. Can you imagine the hue and cry if we, you know, scrapped our centralized missionary system of young boys and said, okay, now everybody needs to spend 15 hours a week. Everybody in every ward needs to spend 15 hours a week, you know, knocking on doors.
Well, can I just follow up?
I'd like to say one thing, take it a step further, and then by all means. One of the things that is fairly clear is that because the better off Mormons, the better off converts are more likely to stay, the members of the congregation are less jaded and more positive towards them and make them feel, spend more time making them feel comfortable. In other words, the church contributes to the pattern that we found.
Okay. The way you presented your data has a lot, the way different groups measure their membership is going to have a large impact on the way this particularly this number comes out, meaning that if the witnesses really make a strong attempt to only measure those that are actively witnessing, then it's very likely that many will still associate with the organization who aren't active, versus those that measure it by anybody that was baptized and see that the number that suggests association are lower. So all things given equal, meaning that for those that were baptized 20 years later, how many of them still associate with the organization? Can you speak to that retention rate across this group, these three groups?
Well, the best measure is the census, okay? Because that is saying right now, what are you? And my friend Henry, who we've both mentioned, who's the anthropologist working in Latin America, says that they leave, they join something else, and they're still being counted on the Mormon rolls. Because in Latin America, there's a fair amount of movement around groups. And I might say that in Africa, there's a sort of, shall we say, multiple insurance policy that happens. In other words, I mean, I've heard this story said many times. Adventists run hospitals, right? An Adventist gets sick, and to make best chances, he goes to the medicine man, the witch doctor, on the way to the hospital. Okay, he's taking, it's the multiple insurance policy, and the an Adventist evangelist comes through and baptizes a number of people, and a year later, a Pentecostal evangelist comes through, and some of those same people will be baptized as Pentecostals, and they will continue to think of themselves as both Adventists and Pentecostals. Multiple insurance.
Ron? Where does Christian Science fit into this? Have you done any study of that at all, or how they are distributed in the world, and what their trajectory is?
I have not done work on them in particular, but I've got a friend who is a Christian Scientist and who's published stuff on them, serious research. Christian Science is on its way down. It's losing membership very rapidly, very rapidly. The question is, will it survive?
Is it mostly American?
As far as I know, it's mostly developed world. It's an interesting sect because it appealed to the higher social classes. This was true in America. You see from the quality of the buildings that they built. They certainly existed in Australia when I was growing up, and I knew one Christian Scientist. For example, in New York, they've recently sold their second church to a Pentecostal group. The first and the second church joined together, and they're still pretty small. They're really on the way down.
There are a lot of membership projections for the future, and I was wondering what sense do either of you have that these conclusions on your data were taken into account in these projections that we see?
Well, the most famous projection comes from a person that Ron and I know and love, Mr. Rodney Stark. It is unlikely that those projections will be accurate. The Shepherds did some projections and appear to have been much more accurate. And I have a colleague at the University of Tampa who looks at growth rates in individual countries and does projections and sort of shows, what to expect in the future. Growth rates have slowed, and it's unclear whether or not this slowing is a trend. It's too soon to tell, I think, whether this slowing is a trend or whether it's a blip in the road. But there's some interesting work, a sociologist from Scotland, who argues that the Mormon missionary strategy is problematic because the pool is becoming fished out. Like it takes less time than you think to knock on every door in Santiago. And when I was a Mormon missionary, I can tell you it takes less time than you think to knock on every door in your area in New Orleans. You know, you end up with, you know, the burned over cities. So a strategy change could open, you know, open up new doors, or ability to go to new countries might open new doors. But, you know, I think it's, you know, I don't make predictions, particularly about the future. But the prediction I will make is that Rodney Stark's projections are not. By the way, way too much has been made of those. The article first appeared as an introduction to a collection of articles on Mormonism in the Review of Religious Research. It was a special issue on Mormonism, and it was meant to be a provocative introductory piece, which was then seized and disseminated widely. And did you want to comment on that?
No, I think you commented.
Obviously, what Stark projected was important to me, and I in one of my papers, which is hopefully coming out soon. I really use this considerably. And he accepted the official data as gospel. He didn't realize the problems of the official data, especially the official Mormon data. And he just simply projected, you know, the same rate that had been happening in the 80s would go up for the next 100 years. And then he and Larry Iannacone did the same thing for the witnesses in the 90s. And the Mormons started to fall rapidly after 1990, and the witnesses started to fall rapidly after 2000. So their timing was terrible. It's just simply not going to happen what they predicted. One of the things which I think is an important ingredient which hasn't come up here is saturation, what I call saturation. And that is that groups grow most rapidly when they first go to a place. Of course, they grow percentage-wise very rapidly, though the numbers may not be so great because they're starting from nothing. And over time, this slows. Adventist growth, for example, which has been really whopping in Africa, has slowed. It's still huge, but it is slowed in the last 10 years compared to what it was before. And what's going on is saturation. Now, saturation affects Mormons and Witnesses much more than it affects Adventists, and that's because Mormons and Witnesses primarily work in urban areas, and you exhaust the urban areas first because you're concentrated. Adventists are spread; they do their rural thing, and they know that they're underrepresented, and they're very aware of this in the cities. But because they're spread to areas where others are not working, this has greatly helped their growth rate. What else was I going to say? I had another point. We'll find it.
It seems that obviously the LDS Church would use this kind of data in determining where temples are built or opened. Is there any sense of kind of the comparison between the growth, retention, the stating that you are Mormon, and this division between, you know, are you Mormon if you're only Temple Mormon or if you're just baptized Mormon?
We know from work that's been done by some demographers at BYU that Mormons that are married in the Temple are far less likely to divorce. The Temple, having gone through the Temple, has a strong effect on religious activity. And it reminds me of a friend of mine who subscribed to Forbes magazine, who's a roommate in college. And I said, Tim, why did you subscribe to Forbes magazine? And he said, well, because I read that 25% of Forbes subscribers are millionaires. I think the church has sort of taken the attitude. You look at the statistics and you see Temple Mormons are much more active than other Mormons. Therefore, we'll, you know, build temples. And I think it's, you know, it's it, the idea is if you build them, they will come. But I don't know, you know, it remains to be seen if that's the case. I think, you know, that being endowed and staying active are both effects of the same cause, which is subjective religious commitment, you know, a strong stake in the church. At least that's, you know, that's what I've noticed. I don't know because I'm not a globetrotter like my colleagues, but I have heard reports of temple sessions that are, you know, largely empty and temples that are under attended, and the building of temples has increased at exponential rates while, you know, membership growth rates have slowed. And I think it is the attitude that if you have the infrastructure, it will make it easier for people to get endowed. But if you're not retaining, you know, even 50% of your members in some of these nations, there isn't anybody, you know, that sticks around long enough to, there are fewer people who stick around long enough to actually be eligible to be endowed. Now, once they do, they're likely to stay, but they were likely to stay probably anyway because of their religious commitments. Does that sort of get at it?
I thought of the thing that I forgot. Ryan Cragan and I are publishing an article in Sociology of Religion in the fall. And in this, we argue that in spite of what certain other sociologists have said, that the evidence is very clear from the data. We've taken data, growth data, on these three groups for every country on Earth. And it is clear that you get this sort of... No, actually, did the wrong way around. This sort of growth pattern. In other words, when you get in the pre-modern societies, the growth is slow. So that Adventists, for example, who were the first to go seriously to the developing world of these three groups, grew slowly there at first. But then once you get to the modernization period, and this particularly followed the end of colonialization, then you get a real wish to be westernized, and somehow Western religions become associated with being westernized, and these groups grow very fast in that period. And then when you get to the postmodern period, the period when they're no longer modernizing, but everything has become the way America is now, and Europe is now, you get huge secularization, and yes, the mainline falls off, as it's been doing since the 1970s. But Rodney Stark said the hope was in these groups, that the sectarian groups would continue to grow. But they're not. The growth has fallen off in the developed world for these groups too. So the prediction is, as countries become more developed, religious growth will decline there. That this period of very rapid growth of the it's been dubbed the Southernization of Christianity, as Christianity has grown so rapidly in the developing world, in Africa, in Latin America, in parts of Asia, in the Pacific Islands. As these become modernized, and of course they've got a fair way to go, but once that happens, then they too will slow. But meanwhile, you do have the saturation thing that I'm talking about. And there is a slowing nevertheless, but it's nothing compared to what happens once you get to the secularizing period.
Okay, our time is gone, I'm sorry to say, but let's give a round of applause for them. Individually, I'm sure they'll be happy to forego their lunch to entertain any conversations up front here.